abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, January 28th, 2014. Peter Schiff joins us today, taking your questions. Peter Schiff, of course, is CEO and Chief Global Strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital, which you can visit at europac.net. You have seen him school the clueless on CNBC, Fox Business, CNN, MSNBC, and other outlets. He's the author of numerous books, including How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, which is now available in a collector's edition, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country, and the New York Times bestseller Crash Proof 2.0, How to Profit from the Economic Collapse. Peter, of course, is the host of The Peter Schiff Show, Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time at SchiffRadio.com. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program Peter Schiff. Peter, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Tom, for having me on.
Now, I solicited questions for you from some of my folks, and filtering out the Ask Peter Why He's So Awesome questions, of course, we have to get to the most important question of all, which is, When are you going to host the Tom Woods Show?
I don't know. When are you going to have me host it?
We'll see. All right. I
have a hard enough time hosting my own show these days. So
yeah, I don't know how you do a 2-hour show every day. I mean, you make it seem easy, whereas for me, I got to like concentrate every minute I'm on there, make sure I'm on my game.
It's easy to do the show when I'm sitting in the chair. The problem is, you know, I travel, I have other commitments, and that's when it gets difficult.
Yeah. Well, you have a stable of people. I think I'm going to commit to do February 5th, so that'll help you at least one day. So anyway, let's focus on this. Suppose you're talking to somebody who, I don't know, person's got $25,000 to play with and yet knows nothing whatsoever about investing. What does that person do?
Well, I mean, they can certainly allow somebody else like me to invest it for them. I mean, at least they knew enough to save the $25,000 and not blow it. But the key is to try to make it grow so that when you save $25,000, it doesn't just sit there. It grows in purchasing power, especially today, because if you just leave $25,000 in the bank, you're going to earn nothing in the way of interest. Meanwhile, the government's going to make sure that consumer prices go up so that your $25,000 loses purchasing power. Also try to make sure that asset prices go up. So if you want to buy an asset, that's going to be more expensive too. So you can't just leave your cash lying around. You have to do something with it. And I would certainly recommend that you invest it with me. I mean, we've got plenty of products, mutual funds. For somebody, for a small amount of money like that, my mutual funds, the minimum investment is just $2,500. I've got 9 to choose from. So people can look at the strategy that's right for them, or they can even go with a combination. At my brokerage account, we actually have managed accounts where, you know, we can manage you, although I think the minimum is $50,000 for a wrap account, for us to manage the portfolio within my family of funds. But people can certainly choose the funds that they like and invest in them.
You know, Dave Ramsey used to say probably, I don't know, 10 years ago, as part of his basic advice to, you know, you got to get out of debt, and then you got to take your money and throw it in a mutual fund. And then he would dazzle the audience with the miracles of compound interest by saying, now look, if this mutual fund is turning around, giving you a 12% return every year, you're going to be like a gazillionaire by the time you retire. But what kind of return can somebody in this day and age, in 2014, seriously expect?
Well, you know, in the stocks that we're buying, when you take a look at the dividend yields that we're able to collect, it wouldn't be that difficult to have returns of that magnitude, especially if you don't factor in inflation. I mean, if you factor in inflation, then obviously the real returns are going to go down. But central banks all around the world are creating a lot of money. And so it's not even you know, about the money you make, but it's the losses that you avoid by not having your money in cash. In fact, if you look at all the articles that are being written now and the speeches by the Fed members, the greatest concern that the central bankers have is that there's not enough inflation. They're worried that prices aren't rising fast enough, and they're going to protect us from the threat of prices that aren't going up fast enough. So you're going to lose a lot if you don't invest money. Although I might discourage people from necessarily paying off debt indiscriminately, because if you do have a lot of inflation, well, that wipes out your debt. So you don't necessarily want to go out of your way to pay off debt. There's certain debt, like credit card debt and high interest rate debt, that you know you definitely would want to pay off. But you know, people that have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, if they've got it fixed at 4%, I wouldn't be so quick to pay those loans off. Or student loans, student loan interest rates are extremely low. I wouldn't be in a hurry to pay those off. In fact, there's a good chance that the government's just going to have a bailout for student loans, just forgive them. So, you know, why be the guy that pays it off? You know, I would rather take the money and do something, you know, more productive with it.
Well, now, how about this concern? I mean, obviously, anytime you're involved in investing, there are risks involved, naturally, right? There's no guarantees in this world. But now, because of the activities of the world's central banks, there's a whole other risk element that's introduced. Because, yeah, it's true that if I sit on the sidelines, I'm going to lose my money because it'll be eroded, the purchasing power will be eroded. But if I get into stocks, then, you know, they can get pumped up by central banks, and then I can take a real hit because of the central bank. So you begin to wonder, then what path should I take? What is the safest way to go?
Well, that's why, you know, when you look at stocks, they're not all the same. And I like to buy stocks that are really like hard asset investments. I want to buy companies that own resources and raw materials, assets around the world. I don't want to pay a very high, you know, ratio, a P.E. ratio. So I'm not going to buy the Twitters of the world. I mean, these are where people are really gambling. But, you know, the Federal Reserve, through its monetary policy, is forcing people to gamble because
right.
You can't just sit in cash. I mean, you used to be able to just buy a CD and play it safe and earn a 5 or 6% return and say, look, I don't want the 10% or the 12%. I don't want to take the risks that come along with that. I'm happy to sit around and get 5 or 6%. But you can't do that anymore because that option is no longer available. In fact, if you sit in cash, not only won't you get your interest, but the value of the money principal is going to go down because inflation is going to rob you of your purchasing power. So you're being forced to do something, which is part of the Fed's plan. They want to force people into the stock market, into the real estate market as speculators because that's their plan to revive the economy. It's to juice these asset bubbles so that we all feel richer and that we can go out and borrow more money because now we have collateral that we can pledge to borrow money, and now we can go out and take that borrowed money and spend it almost as if we'd actually earned it. And so then we can have this whole phony economy based on ever-increasing asset prices because nobody's going to save. But, of course, we all know from economics that the real root of economic growth comes from savings, that we need underconsumption to finance the capital investment that grows the economy, that leads to greater production of goods and meaningful jobs. Instead, the way the U.S. economy works is we use our inflated asset values to borrow money from foreigners to buy the products that they made so that we don't actually need a growing economy to consume. We just need an asset that we can leverage.
All right, let me give you a scenario. Let's suppose you're 30 years old and you've got 200 grand in the bank. What percentage of that would you hold in cash?
Very little. I hold very little cash myself. I mean, I have cash to help run my businesses, so I have operating expenses and I have regulatory capital that needs to be kept in dollars. But most people don't have that. I mean, if you're a 30-year-old guy, you know, I wouldn't have any more than 6 months to a year's worth of expenses in cash. You know, I'd make sure I had a little cash, you know, cover my rent or cover my mortgage if you have a mortgage. But I would keep very little in the way of cash because it's just going to lose value. I mean, I would rather buy the things that I think I'm going to need next year. You know, not things that are likely to go on sale. I mean, don't go out. I mean, look, I just went shopping yesterday at the Gap, and I bought a couple shorts that were 85% off. I mean, I paid $6 for, you know, $40 shorts, and I got some stuff at 75% off, you know. But things, staples, you know, things that they're just going to go up in price, you know, basic goods. are going to get more. I'd rather store those in my basement than have money in cash. You know, even those forever post stamps are probably better than having cash. I mean, the post office just raised the price of a stamp by 6.5%. They'll probably do another 6.5% next year. So, but I mean, everything is getting more expensive. So why would you want to hold on to cash?
It seems not risky, but of course, there is the risk, more than a risk, it's a certainty that the purchasing power will be eroded, but maybe you think that the erosion of the purchasing power is not great enough to justify throwing it in a mutual fund and crossing your fingers. I mean, I'm just trying to think about the average person.
Well, it's not just crossing your fingers if we're doing it strategically, but even you don't necessarily have to be in a mutual fund. I mean, you can buy gold or silver. I mean, you know, you don't have to leave it in, or you can even buy foreign currency, but, you know, I'd prefer, as long as it's, you know, you're going to just not get any interest, you might as well buy gold or silver. I mean, people think, oh, well, but gold can go down because it went down, you know, 28% or whatever it did in 2013. Yeah, well, that's the first year in 13 that it went down. The other years have been up years. I think the odds are pretty good. In fact, the odds that 2014 is going to be a down year for gold, I think is pretty slim. So I think that if people are worried about losing their purchasing power in dollars, they can certainly hold their purchasing power in gold or silver. And, you know, years from now, I think they'll be able to buy a lot more stuff with their gold and silver than they will with their dollars.
You know, Peter, I hesitate to ask you a question that you're probably asked an awful lot. Like, I want to ask you slightly, if not off the wall, then at least questions that are interesting to you. But and I'm sure you have sort of a stock answer for this, so to speak, but I just need to ask, because so many people want to know, the thinking behind a strategy that involves foreign investments, given that, I mean, the argument you hear all the time is that, well, these foreign governments are just as crummy, if not crummier, than the U.S. government. So why would we give them preference and all that? Like, what do you say to that?
Well, they're not just as crummy. I mean, there are some that are, and, you know, we avoid those countries. I mean, we try to invest in the countries where the governments are the least crummy, right, where the economic fundamentals are the best. And so, you know, none of the countries are perfect, but, you know, we're a lot further from perfection than the countries that I'm investing in. So, and the idea is, like, you know, most people don't want to just have all their money in gold, you know, and so, you know, foreign stock portfolios give you the exposure of the stock market. They give you the dividend yields associated with stocks, which, you know, you don't get any income from your gold investment. So to the extent that you're sitting on gold, you're giving up the opportunity to earn a return, a cash return. But when you own stocks that pay dividends, you get that. And you also get the currency effects. If you're buying sounder economies with, you know, where they have budget surpluses in their governments, trade surpluses, high savings rates, you know, these countries are going to have appreciating currencies relative to the dollar. You get some of that inflation hedge in the foreign exchange. You get the hard assets that these companies own. But, you know, we're not the cleanest shirt in the hamper. You know, everybody likes to say, oh yeah, you know, we got problems, but, you know, everybody else's are worse. No, they're not. I mean, there are plenty of countries that are lending money. I mean, that's the reason that we can borrow. Somebody has to be doing the lending. There are plenty of countries that are actually producing consumer goods in abundance because, you know, they're here. They're on the shelves in Walmart. They had to get there somehow. Some economy had to produce that stuff. You know, so there is real production. There is savings and underconsumption going on, and there is real economic growth going on the planet. And I want to participate in that. I don't want to simply be in gold and just hope that everything collapses, you know, to make my gold portfolio go up. Even though I believe that these bubbles are going to burst, you know, I don't want to have all my eggs in one basket. And, you know, even if I'm wrong, you know, I guess there's always the chance that I could have this whole thing wrong, and maybe Ben Bernanke is a genius and everything he did was exactly what we needed, and, you know, maybe I'm wrong. That doesn't necessarily mean that buying quality stocks outside the United States, you know, at good prices with good yields, is going to be a bad idea. You know, I can still make money even if I'm wrong. I make a lot more money if I'm right, but I don't necessarily lose. But if you put all your money in gold and then we're wrong and, you know, and everything is great and gold goes way down, then we just lose, right? So I'd rather have a portfolio that can do well if I'm wrong, you know, but still do really well if I'm right.
You know, this brings to mind another listener question, which is, let's suppose the language barrier is not an issue and you have no sort of residual attachment to a particular country. you were just impartially looking at the whole world, where would you live?
Well, you know, I haven't, you know, been around the whole world, and so I haven't lived there in all these different countries. I mean, I've traveled a bit, and there are, you know, countries that I like. I think that, you know, countries that have the most amount of freedom is, you could, you know, look in Asia, or even some of the countries in South America, not all of them, look at Chile or look at Peru, or, you know, obviously Singapore, you know, in Asia, and some, even some of these smaller countries where there's a lot of opportunity, even the Middle East, you know, you could be in Dubai, but, you know, New Zealand is a great place to be. I mean, there are places where, you know, there aren't as many regulations. If you can go to even Shanghai and mainland China, I mean, you know, there are countries that people can go if you're young and entrepreneurial, and you want to be able to build something and you don't want to pay these high taxes. You know, there are countries where, you know, you do have more economic freedom, more opportunity to create, you know, wealth. I mean, they're here. There are people that are making fortunes in the United States, but they're few and far between. You know, so that the odds are stacked against you over here. So people can tilt the odds by being in other countries. And it's even going to get worse as when the economic bubble bursts, because some of the people that are making money in the U.S., you know, maybe they're starting some, you know, dot-com company, some social media company that's not actually generating a profit, but they can sell stock. And so eventually that window is going to close, you know, when the bubble bursts. And so, you know, you'll have to, you know, actually come up with a profit-making business to get rich in America. And, you know, the government makes it harder and harder to do that.
Well, back in the U.S., where do you think the housing market is right now, and where do you see it going, let's say, a few years from now?
Well, I mean, I think the government has managed to reflate the housing bubble, which, you know, was their goal. But it's a different type of bubble than it was before. Before, you know, everybody was buying. You know, poor people were just stretching to buy houses they couldn't afford. They were taking all kinds of crazy mortgages to get into these homes. That stopped, you know, by and large. I mean, there are still some people that are getting 3.5 down, you know, with, you know, FHA-type loans. But home ownership rates have plunged. I mean, they're at maybe like a 20-year low now. So a lot of people who, you know, were buying homes they couldn't afford are now renting, and they're having to deal with rising rents, which is a big problem. But the new buyers are the hedge funds, the private equity funds that used to be buying, you know, stocks, now are buying real estate. If you look at December sales figures for December 2013, nationwide, it was about 42% of all the homes were bought for all cash. In places like Florida, it was better than 60% of the homes were purchased for cash. These are not homeowners who are going to live in their houses. These are not even people who are buying vacation houses. You know, nobody pays all cash for a $200,000 or $300,000 house and then lives in it, right? I mean, if you have $300,000 and you're going to live in the house, you're going to use it as a down payment, right, for a $1 million house. You're not, you know, going to buy a $200,000 house. These are speculators. You know, I mean, you know, if you can, you know, the average American, if he's going to live in a $200,000 house, he's lucky if he can even scrape up $20,000 for a down payment. So these are speculators. And where are they getting the money to buy these houses? Well, they're getting it from investors, or they're leveraged up. They can borrow money at, you know, 1.5%, and maybe even cheaper. Some of these funds have really, you know, good inroads into the cheap money. They can borrow a lot of money and go pay cash for these houses. And they're planning on renting them out or planning on flipping them to some other hedge fund at a profit. But eventually this is going to blow up. You know, they're overpaying for these houses. They're dreaming if they think they're going to find tenants, because most people can't afford to pay a rent that would be adequate, you know, even with today's interest rates, let alone a rise in interest rates. People generally don't want to rent a single-family home. There's too much headache there. They generally want multifamily. They want an apartment. They don't want a house with a yard and all those hassles. I mean, some people do. But I also think it's going to be very difficult for these hedge funds to manage these properties in the way that they think. I think they're going to have a lot of problems with the tenants. They're going to have a lot of problems with repair bills. They have no idea in many cases what they've purchased. They've come in and they swoop down and they buy up all these homes at once. And, you know, they're not going to know what the problems are until they get a tenant in there. And then the tenant comes in and says, oh, this is wrong and that is wrong. And all of a sudden they're going to blow years worth of rent on maintenance. And so I think, this is going to be a big disaster. But, you know, the Fed is trying to keep it going with cheap money. But, you know, the housing market's going to come down, you know. And the only reason it won't come down is if the Fed just refuses to allow rates to rise, in which case, you know, the dollar will come crashing down instead of the houses.
Well, Peter, let's shift gears just because I know we're low on time. And I had so many people when I solicited questions for this program, and people are curious about your father. And I, you know, maybe it's a sensitive subject, but can you tell us what exactly did he get in trouble for? Was there some way that he could have done whatever he was doing that he couldn't have gotten in trouble? I mean, what's the deal and how is he?
Well, yeah, we don't really have enough time to get into all that. But my dad, you know, has been on a crusade since the mid-70s or early 70s to kind of force the U.S. government to obey the law with respect to the collection of income taxes. And, you know, through his research, he concluded on his own that, you know, there is no legal requirement to pay income taxes, that the way the code is written, the income tax is based on voluntary compliance, and it's voluntary for a reason, because if it were mandatory, it would be illegal, it would be unconstitutional. He's read all the Supreme Court decisions that bear on it. He's an expert on the case law. He thoroughly understands, at least from his perspective. And so, you know, he hasn't filed tax returns, or he's filed tax returns claiming zero. But he never did it in a way to be sneaky or deceitful. It's not like he's, you know, most people, you know, believe they owe income taxes, and then maybe they lie. They misreport, they don't report all their income, or they inflate their deductions, they hide their money, they try to figure out how to, you know, not pay the taxes. Well, my father basically, you know, I'm not paying because I'm not required to, the government's breaking the law, and he goes on television, he goes on radio, and he says, I'm not paying my taxes, and here's why. You know, so he's not hiding anything from the government. He's in the government's face saying, you know, I'm not required to pay, and neither is anybody else. And there were a lot of people for some time that were following my father. He wrote a best-selling book, How Anyone Can Stop Paying Income Taxes. It was a best-selling book, sold a couple hundred thousand copies, and he wrote other books, and he's probably sold 500,000 books all told of all those various books. And a lot of people were following his advice, so the government had to do something about it. They had to discredit him. They had to shut him up. And he spent, you know, probably the majority of his last 20 years or 25 years in jail. I mean, he's been in jail now for almost 8 years. He's been in and out a few times. You know, the first time he went was like 1980, 81. Then he was out. Then that was only like 6 months. Then he was in again for 5 years or so in the 90s. And now this most recent, you know, this 8-year stretch, he got 13 years this time. But, you know, the amounts of taxes that he supposedly evaded, the amounts are very small. The majority of the money that he theoretically owes is interest and penalties. It's not the actual tax. I mean, I pay more in taxes every year than my father evaded over his entire lifetime, according to the government. So, you know, you figure they can give him credit for that. But no, I mean, he's really a political prisoner. I don't think he's done anything wrong. I don't think there's any evidence that he's done anything wrong, at least, you know, from a, you can say that he's wrong. You can say that my father is mistaken. And on most of his beliefs, I don't think he's mistaken. I think he's actually correct. And I've talked to a lot of lawyers and judges even that said they agree with my dad. But they just said, well, but the government's not going to let him get away with it because there's too much at stake. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about, you know, him being right on his issues. But even if you approach it from the fact that he's wrong, he's mistaken, he's misreading these court cases, he doesn't understand the Internal Revenue Code, if you just say that he's made a mistake, well, that's not a crime. It's not a crime to be wrong. If you have a good faith belief that what you're doing is right, that you're not breaking the law, then that's not a crime. It's not supposed to be a crime. It can be a civil, you can have to pay a fee, a fine, you can, you know, the government can try to collect the taxes anyway, but they can't just put you in jail. But the thing with my father is, you know, his most recent trial, and that, you know, you put that in quotes because it's not really, it's more like a star chamber, but the government didn't even have any witnesses that testified against him. They didn't even have any evidence that they could submit. They just basically say, you know, he doesn't pay his taxes, so send him to jail, you know, and they don't even put in any evidence, any witnesses, and if my father tried to put evidence up in his behalf, they just refused to allow him to submit it. It's all you can't admit that, you can't admit this. I mean, they basically don't let you put on a case. And the only people that you have on the jury are people who have never been audited. Most of them, you know, because they won't. If you've been audited, you can't be on a jury for a tax case. Now, I mean, that's going to let almost every small businessman, you know, you can't be on a tax case. Who's there? Retired teachers, people on Social Security, you know, and then they get all these jurors and they say, if you acquit Irwin Schiff, the government's not going to have the money to pay your Social Security benefits.
Right, right.
So you better convict him, otherwise you're going to be out on the street eating cat food. Right? I mean, you know, so they basically stack the jury. The judge, you know, the prosecutor lies to the jury, and then the judge lies to the jury and basically says, he's guilty, convict him. I mean, that's basically what happened if you read the transcripts. So there's no real justice. You know, he's a political prisoner, the same as they have political prisoners in, you know, other countries. He's there because it's convenient for the government to keep him there, because the government wants to shut him up.
Well, this most recent time that he was put in jail, how long has he been there?
He's been there 8 years. I said it was a 13-year sentence, so he's got, you know, whatever, 4 more years left.
Good grief. I mean, obviously there are people, well, I'm sure you...
And he's 86.
Yeah.
And you know, the funny thing, you know, people, I mentioned it on my radio show today, but if people, you know, you want to know about government health care, my father's got government health care because he's in a prison, right? And so he had a problem. He had to go to the emergency room because he had some pain, like a boil that just came up on his leg or, you know, and so he had to sit in the emergency room for 18 hours before a doctor even saw him.
Unbelievable.
You know, but yeah, I mean, the whole thing, the prison system is a disaster. And, you know, they keep him in prison. They, you know, they don't keep him in a prison that's anywhere near where his family is, because they make it very difficult for him to get visitors. You know, I mean, there's plenty of prisons within driving distance of all of his family, yet they won't let him go to one of those. So he's in Dallas, Texas, and they just transferred him there not too long ago because he was in Indiana. But you think they'd put him in a prison in Connecticut or New York or New Jersey? No, no. You know, why would they do that? Why would they make it easy for his children and grandchildren to visit him?
Yeah, and you know, get the feeling that if he were a murderer, they probably would. Like,
if he were a murderer, he would have been acquitted. They had no evidence. I mean, if they don't have evidence against you, you know, and if he was a murderer, he would have had a fair trial. I mean, the government doesn't give a damn if a murderer goes free, but if a tax protester goes free,
right, yeah, ain't
that's
not
scary.
Ain't gonna happen, right? Right. All right, Peter. I know we're out of time, but I appreciate you being with me and taking some listener questions. Always appreciate. We all love watching you on TV, smacking the bad guys down. Keep on doing that. I hope everybody's tuning in for ShiftRadio.com Monday through Friday, 10 to noon. You know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, where are you going to get better listening than that? Thanks again, Peter. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks again for hosting for me when I'm not around.
My pleasure. All right, my thanks to Peter Schiff. A couple quick but important announcements. I will be in Maryland and Pennsylvania and Idaho and Arkansas in the coming months. Check out those events. Get details at TomWoods.com. My personal site, TomWoods.com/events, is the events page. Remember, tomorrow night, Wednesday, January 29th, there is a great event going on at libertyclassroom.com/live. We're having a 90-minute Q&A with me and with my two historian partners in crime, Kevin Gutzman and Brian McClanahan. This is usually reserved for members only, but we're opening this one up to the general public. Bring all your questions on history. If you want the real thing, this is where you get it. Not the propaganda from school, but the real history. Come on over to libertyclassroom.com/live tomorrow night, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and join us. Whether you have a question or not, I guarantee you'll have some fun. And finally, help me keep this office here, my little Tom Woods Show office, at no cost to yourself by entering Amazon through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the program on iTunes, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.